supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The city of Philadelphia has decided to forego its call to move the Made in America event from the Ben Franklin Parkway. WHYY's Tom McDonald talked to the mayor late this afternoon and joins us now live on the line. Tom?
Dave, Mayor Jim Kenney says promoter Jay-Z didn't know about the city's desire to move the event off the parkway, triggering an op-ed when he found out about it that brought the change into the spotlight. After a face-to-face meeting with the CEO of Roc Nation this morning, the mayor says the city decided not to make the change.
I mean, we were talking to the folks on the ground, and apparently they weren't giving him information. And when it came public, that he wasn't happy. And so we had a really frank discussion today about some operational stuff, and very cooperative and very give and take. And we'll get it right.
The change was proposed because residents surrounding the event complained too many events are on the parkway. Mayor Jim Kenney says the city will work with residents to make the event easier on their everyday lives.
I've had conversations with people who live out there. You get both opinions. Some people don't like it at all. Some people like it. And we'll work with the public engagement people to deal with the issues as we move towards Labor Day this year and moving towards next year. So,
the mayor says the city actually denied a request by the NFL to have a festival on the parkway in connection with the Eagles' opening night. That event will be held at Penn's Landing. Desiree Perez, CEO of Roc Nation, says they're happy the event will continue on the parkway for many years to come, and they're confident previous miscommunication has been corrected, Dave.
Tom, this announcement seems short on specifics. Do we know how many years or how many dollars?
No, at this point they don't, because everything gets worked out literally last minute. The stuff hasn't been worked out for this year's concert yet, Dave, let alone next year's.
And then in that context, why did it take this long to come to these broad strokes of an agreement?
It was a matter of putting everybody in one room face to face. The mayor actually left his office at City Hall, traveled out to Conshohocken for this meeting. He said once he sat down with the head of Live Nation, everything came together quickly.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome, Dave.
In other news this evening, Vice President Mike Pence addressed some 300 supporters in Philadelphia today at a Center City hotel. In what resembled a campaign speech, Pence praised the Trump administration's policies over the past year and a half on immigration, the canceled Iran nuclear deal, and low unemployment, and the tax cuts that came with the Republican tax overhaul.
We cut taxes for working families. A typical family of four in Philadelphia, it's probably going to save about $2,500 every year on their taxes after this bill is fully in effect.
Not everyone is cheering the new tax law. New Jersey is one of four states suing the federal government, claiming the legislation unfairly singles out blue states with high taxes. In New Jersey, the average property tax bill is nearly $9,000, and the tax overhaul championed by Republicans and the Trump administration capped a deduction for state and local taxes at $10,000. As that battle now winds its way through the courts, the debate is also taking place among federal lawmakers and IRS officials. WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo offers this report.
Initially, Republican leaders wanted to scrap the state and local mortgage tax deduction altogether in their overhaul of the tax code. But many Republicans rebuffed that effort and were able to convince party leaders to cap the deductions at $10,000 annually. While that compromise won over some Northeastern votes for the GOP tax plan, it wasn't enough for many.
I think New Jersey was screwed.
That's South Jersey Republican Congressman Frank Lobiondo, who's still dumbfounded by that provision in the $1.5 trillion GOP tax package. The New Jersey legislature and the governor came back at Congress and passed a bill that allows school districts, municipalities, and counties to create their own charitable funds. Homeowners would give to the fund and get a credit towards their property tax bill. And since deductions for charitable contributions aren't capped, they can get a deduction worth more than that $10,000. Now there's chatter on Capitol Hill about blocking states like New Jersey from using this fix. Lobiondo, who's retiring after this term, says that would fly in the face of his party's long-standing support of states' rights.
By not having that deduction, which has been forever, and, you know, the fact that we might want to do something at the state level and have it blocked down here, I think would be really wrong.
But South Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur maintains his own state legislature and governor are the ones who stepped over the line.
What New Jersey is doing is nothing more than a game. You can't make a charitable contribution, get something of value in return, and call it a charitable contribution. It doesn't work that way. You know, why not buy a car and pay for it with a charitable contribution and write off, you know, everyone knows intuitively that that's just a gimmick.
For MacArthur, there's a simple solution.
I think New Jersey would be far better off, instead of fighting federal law, figuring out how to reduce New Jersey's tax burden on its citizens. That's the answer. That's the only answer.
But Central New Jersey Republican Congressman Leonard Lance disagrees. He supported much in the tax bill, but he ended up voting against it because of the cap on this deduction. He argues that Trenton should decide his residents' taxes, not Washington. And he says Garden State taxpayers already send more money to Washington than the state gets back.
New Jersey is a sending state, not a receiving state. And if we're going to look at these provisions in the code, we have to do it across the board. And I assure the people across the United States that New Jersey sends a great deal of revenue, more to Washington than we receive back.
Lance says the simple fix is to allow states like New Jersey and others to go back to allowing their residents to deduct whatever the state wants them to deduct.
I think that we should continue to have the deductibility of state and local taxes at 100%. That has been in our tax code since 1913, the advent of the modern code, and I'm sorry that it was reduced in the tax bill. I want it fully deductible. The original tax proposal was not to be able to deduct any amount. It's at $10,000 now, and I want it restored to where we can deduct the full amount.
Still, MacArthur stands by the tax overhaul he helped get over the finish line.
They've been wrong, wrong, wrong on these declarations. Jersey businesses are growing. They're paying more in salaries. They're investing in new plant and equipment and people. And so legislature and the governor, I can fuss all they want, but the reality is federal tax policy is leaving more money in families and businesses in New Jersey. It's time for New Jersey to do the same thing.
Jersey Democrats see it differently. Here's Congressman Bill Pascrell from North Jersey.
The average increase in home mortgages are going to go through the roof. And there's no two ways about it. It's been a great attraction to buying homes, usually and being able to sustain yourself in the home after you buy it is very, very important. And that is crippling New Jersey's economy.
Now that New Jersey has joined New York and two other blue states in a lawsuit saying capping deductions at the federal level is unconstitutional, Pascrell says he's less worried about the potential for federal lawmakers to undercut Jersey.
We'll see if they stand up. I think New Jersey is right on course and challenging. If not this, we'll go to something else. I mean, we have a variation of what New York is doing. So we're not going to back off. There's no two ways about it.
Still, Pascrell and other Jersey Democrats are making the pitch about restoring those state and local tax deductions central to their pitch to voters to put them back in charge of the House this fall. And they say, if they're in power, they have a plan to overturn the policy, even if the courts rule in the GOP's favor. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
A once-a-day pill can prevent HIV infection, called PrEP, short for pre-exposure prophylaxis. The treatment is meant for those who have not been exposed to the disease but are at high risk of getting HIV. In Philadelphia, nearly two-thirds of new HIV infections occur in communities of color. About 75% of PrEP patients are white. As WHYY's Dana Bate reports, one local hospital is trying to extend the care to more people.
Would you like a pretzel?
It's a sunny afternoon in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood, and outside a local library, HIV outreach workers are handing out pretzels, cold water, and information about PrEP.
It is a prevention, so it keeps you HIV negative.
The workers are from Einstein Health. That's the big medical center that serves North Philadelphia. When the hospital ramped up HIV testing about 3 years ago, the team realized how many of their patients, most of whom are African American, had never heard of PrEP. So in January, Einstein started a two-pronged approach to increase awareness. Within the hospital, they started educating primary care doctors about PrEP, when to prescribe it, and who might benefit. And outside the hospital, they've taken the message into the neighborhoods they serve, visiting local libraries, churches, and barbershops. They even set up inside a North Philly ShopRite.
We were right behind the cabbages and next to the plants talking about sex.
That's John Rose, Einstein's community prevention and linkage navigator. He's African American, and this is personal for him. This is his community, too, and he says it's important for everyone to have access to information about PrEP.
Many people that we talk to, they either have never heard of it or they're suspicious of it. And either way, that's problematic. So we are trying to bridge that gap.
Doing that has its challenges. Rose approached a woman outside the library who was so worried about her privacy that she didn't want to give her full name. She asked us to call her Sally B. She said it had been a long time since she'd come across any educational information about HIV directed at her and her neighbors. But after only a few minutes of chatting with Rose, she felt engaged.
I think it's an excellent thing that you're doing to inform our community about, you know, what preventative measures are out there.
That's exactly what these outreach workers are hoping to do.
Is anybody I can contact?
One neighbor at a time. Dana Bate, WHYY News.
Today's official launch of University Alliance for Refugees and At-Risk Migrants was marked by a day-long conference co-sponsored by Rutgers Global and Rutgers Graduate School Newark, whose dean, Dr. Kyle Farbury, delivered opening remarks this morning and joins me now on Newsworks Tonight. Dr. Farbury, thanks for being here this evening.
Thank you for having me.
What is the scope of the project?
So the University Alliance is an alliance of researchers and practitioners and people who are just sort of generally interested in finding ways that universities can take an active role in the current refugee and migration trends that are occurring in the U.S. as well as in other parts of the world.
What has Rutgers been doing to date in this regard?
Well, we have a number of activities. One, Rutgers has been the host of a handful of refugee scholars or scholars at risk, people who might be from a country whose safety might be at risk because of their academic endeavors. So we've had, over the past few years, people from Turkey. We've had in the past some people from Syria and other countries, you know, some from some nations in Africa, where because of some of the academic or scholarly activity that they're involved with at a given time, they've had to flee their countries and are now what are labeled as at-risk scholars. We also have found ways that we've been able to support students of ours who might be refugee students who've had to flee countries because of their refugee status or because of their status of at-risk migrants. So those are some of the things that we've done. And one of the things at Rutgers, and we're finding actually today as we're interacting with colleagues from a number of other universities, is that universities provide both safe spaces for people to continue with their intellectual endeavors, and universities can also play a critical role in terms of helping to integrate members of refugee communities into their local communities.
Your specific remarks spoke to this to the extent that it was titled Universities as Potential Partners. How can schools contribute to the goals of the Global Compacts on Migration and Refugees? Describe these Global Compacts.
So there are actually two compacts. They've been negotiated over really the past few years among different international organizations and different governments. The compact where we've seen sort of the most momentum recently has been through something called the Global Compact for Migration. And this is a compact where negotiations actually were finalized about a week and a half ago. The compact will be formally adopted in a meeting that will take place in December in Marrakesh. Basically, it's a non-binding statement that maps out how not only nations, but also non-governmental organizations and other sort of interested parties and institutions can take a different spin in terms of how they're working on issues of migration.
Following today's launch, what are some realistic short-term goals for furthering the alliance's ends?
Well, we have a few initiatives. One, we're right now talking through some of the different research agendas that we can be involved with. a research agenda where we can connect with community stakeholders, with national stakeholders and international stakeholders, and look at trends and try to find ways that we can build proactive solutions for working with campuses and working with the communities that campuses might interact with to sort of facilitate better integration strategies. Right now, we're in a conversation looking at ways of carrying a very different message out to the media on some of the positive elements around immigration and some of the positive elements around integration strategies, to hopefully be able to provide a very different narrative than I think some pockets of the media right now on providing that tend to be anti-migrant and anti-newcomer. And also we're looking at these documents, which we talked about a moment ago, the Global Compact for Migration and the Global Compact for Refugees, and looking at ways that we can partner with some of the institutions that have been driving those conversations to look at implementable policies.
Dr. Farbrey, congratulations on today's launch, and thank you for taking time to join us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Certainly. Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Kyle Farbrey is Dean of the Rutgers Graduate School in Newark, and we're discussing the University Alliance for Refugees and At-Risk Migrants. This year's outdoor performances of Shakespeare in West Philadelphia's Clark Park will have a glam rock feel. The production of Twelfth Night, a gender confusion comedy, will feature an 8-piece rock band comprised of kids from the neighborhood. WHYY's Peter Crimmins explains.
Twelfth Night opens with its famous line, "If music be the food of love, play on and on and on." Shakespeare wrote several musical interludes into this play about courtly romance, where the objects of love are not always the gender they appear. Director Jack Tamburi says the 400-year-old play seems to anticipate the extravagances of rock and roll.
It's a world of courtly decadence. It's a world where a lot of the comedy is tinged with melancholy, and it's a world of gender confusion. A lot of those elements swirled together bring to my mind the conceptual musical performance stuff of David Bowie, of Brian Eno and early Roxy music, of Freddie Mercury and Queen, of course, of Little Richard, who's sort of the granddaddy of them all.
Shakespeare in Clark Park has made it its mission to encourage community participation in its plays. This time around, it formed a rock band out of open auditions of kids. Music director Jackie Sorrell was surprised by the talent she saw in young people 8 to 15 years old.
Regardless of age, like, Cooper is absolutely fabulous. He's 8, you know? He just, like, fell on our doorstep, a gift from the angels.
Sorrell was talking about the drummer, Cooper Fenton, who at his young age is already something of a ringer. He often plays gigs with a band called Bad Kitty.
Funk music. They invite me to play the drums, so it's pretty fun.
Cooper and this band, called Midsummer Madness, back up the court jester of the play, Festy, played by cabaret performer Jess Conda. She wrote lyrics inspired by, but not faithful to, the original Shakespeare.
So much of glam rock was inspired by identity, right? And having an identity that's bigger than the self. It's like, be your full self, be your truest self, be your most glittery, you know, beyond imaginable self. And in 2018, I think that's important because these are old stories, so we have to figure out why we're still telling them.
You can see Twelfth Night at Clark Park Wednesday through Sunday this week. If it rains, and it probably will, the performance will move indoors at the Annenberg Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And then there were 79. Let's celebrate Jupiter's growing family with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this is a big family for sure.
When I was an elementary school student, I remember that we were learning that Jupiter had 9 moons and Saturn had 12. And that was amazing because the moon was our only satellite. Mars had 2. So for these two planets to have so many at that time was truly amazing. However, with the advent of the Voyager spacecraft doing their close approach flybys in the 1970s and 80s, we learned that there were many, many more moons and rings as well for Saturn and for Jupiter, a ring, actually. And so what we were seeing was that you could count smaller and smaller and smaller objects in orbit around those planets. And then it was a question of how small did you want to measure an object to count it as a moon? This latest edition of moons certainly has some interesting quirks to it. 9 of those newly discovered 12 orbit around the planet in the opposite direction of the planet's rotation.
Is that a sign that they were captured from somewhere else?
It certainly is an indication that there was some squirrely dynamics going on in the early history of the solar system. As to captured, we don't know that yet, can't answer that yet. But if you continue to look a little further, what you find is that the last 3 of those in that group of 12 orbit around the planet in a prograde direction, going with the rotation. Let's make it even squirrelier than that. 1 of those 3 orbits around in a prograde direction with the rotation, but its orbit cuts across the path of those 9 that orbit in the opposite direction.
Who plays traffic cop on Jupiter?
I don't know, but they're going to have a real problem on their hands at some point in the future. I mean, you could say that up until now, nothing has happened. There's been no collision of these. But at some point, it seems inevitable that there will be a collision between that 1 and those other 9, simply because of the fact it's almost like you're driving a car against the flow of traffic on a 9-lane highway, and you're trying to cross from one side of the highway to the other side of the highway.
Why do Jupiter and Saturn have so many moons, or is it more appropriate to wonder why we only have one?
Well, it's probably more appropriate to wonder why we only have one, or to even wonder why Mercury and Venus have no moons at all. It seems as if the way in which planets ought to go is that they have moons. Uranus has 27 moons. Neptune has 13 moons. We know that Pluto has 5 moons, I think it is. And so it seems that would be a normal feature of planets to have moons. One thing we can point to for sure is that the gas giants of the solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, have the gravitational wherewithal to pull more material toward them in orbit around them. So as the solar system is forming, all of the hunks of dirt and trash hanging around at the beginning of the solar system can get pulled into orbits around these larger ones.
So stars ought to have planets. Planets ought to have moons. It's getting awful crowded around here. What's the count in our solar system?
Well, we're up to 175 right now, but that number could still grow because we haven't fully investigated all of the possibility of moons for either Jupiter or Saturn. There could be more. And that's just looking at what we would think of as the known planets. Once the definition for planet becomes settled, it may be that we have to look at those outer objects that are being considered as being brought into the fold of planets that could run the number all the way up to as many as 110 planets in our solar system, depending how you define planet. And then we have to think about the possibility of moons that could be orbiting those objects as well. So there's a lot more to discover here.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.